Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Sharon and Stan had just put their kids to bed and were having a heated discussion. "Now," Sharon was saying, "I am the one who takes the kids to the doctor, so you might just want to trust me on this." "As I said," fumed Stan, "it's not a question of trusting you. I'm just not sure that I trust what the doctor told you, that's all." "Well, honey," Sharon tried to be understanding, "I know you want to protect the kids, but really the pediatrician did tell me that right now no one is vaccinating kids against anthrax."
"But what about smallpox?" persisted Stan. "Did you ask him about that?"
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about bioterrorism in order to protect our children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is uniquely suited to talking with us about these issues. Dr. Julia McMillan is a professor of pediatrics at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She's a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Task Force on Terrorism and a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Diseases as well. Dr. McMillan has three grown children, two sons ages 17 and 21, and a daughter age 24. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. McMillan.
Thanks very much.
The term bioterrorism is terrifying for all of us. Can you explain for us what would happen in an attack of bioterrorism?
Well, one of the most frightening things about bioterrorism is that we don't know what would happen in an attack. It would vary a great deal depending on what the agent of bioterrorism was. I think probably that's best exemplified by what we already know about anthrax and how that was spread and how little we understood really about how it would be spread. It was spread much more easily than we expected, smaller quantities, traveling through the mail in envelopes, disseminated much more broadly than we had any reason to believe would occur. There were a few scientists who had speculated about that possibility, but most people really didn't think it would spread as widely as it did. Remember that we're dealing with infectious agents that we know about, but that haven't ever been used intentionally to hurt people. That's not exactly true. Some of them have in the long-distant past been used intentionally to hurt people, but in general, that isn't the way they've been distributed. They've been naturally seen in much, much smaller quantities without the force of some disseminating mechanism. So for anthrax, we learned a great deal. We know that it does disseminate through the air, but it also can infect the skin. If we were talking about a different kind of infecting agent, like smallpox, smallpox distributes from person to person most effectively, but it also theoretically and almost certainly could be distributed through the air and potentially infect a large number of people at once. We don't know if one city would be involved, if one room would be involved, if several places at once would be involved. So that's the problem. We don't know completely how to prepare for these kinds of things.
Is smallpox something that somebody could take a vial and there would be a serum or something and just open it up?
I'm trying to picture
how that would be disseminated.
No, it doesn't exist just in a vial. I mean, it can exist in tissue culture in a vial, but that's not the way it would be spread. It could potentially and theoretically be aerosolized into a ventilation duct or an air conditioning system or something.
So people would breathe it in.
Right. It's most effectively spread from person to person. So one person who is sick, not who's just been infected, one has to actually be sick
with the symptoms
to infect someone else.
As I understand it, there's no one in the world sick with smallpox right now.
As far as we know, there's been no smallpox in the world since 1978, no smallpox vaccination in the world since 1980, other than people who are working in the laboratory with smallpox-type viruses who are protected with vaccine.
As I understand it, all those of us of a certain age who had gotten smallpox vaccines are no longer protected against that.
As far as we understand, that's true. Smallpox vaccine has been around longer than any other vaccine. Benjamin Franklin's first son died of smallpox, and he always blamed himself because he had resisted having him immunized. His second and third children he did have immunized. So this is a vaccine about which we've had to make decisions for a very long time. There was a reason why Benjamin Franklin resisted immunizing his first son. This is a vaccine that has a much higher rate of side effects than any other vaccine that we've ever used on a broad scale.
This is the same vaccine since
essentially the
1700s?
Same vaccine.
Wow.
We have a population of people who are under 25 or 30 or so who've never gotten vaccine in this country and in most places in the world. That's different from any time that we have good recorded history about. And we have no people who are naturally immune. As devastating a disease as smallpox is, it never killed more than about 30% of the people who became infected with it. So there were a number of people, the majority of people, who had had smallpox and were naturally immune. None of those people exist anymore.
What other diseases do we know of that could easily be transmitted in a bioterrorist attack?
It's not easy to distribute any of these agents. While it looked as though it was easy to distribute anthrax just through an envelope, it does take a good bit of skill to be able to grow and dry the anthrax organism to the point that it's infectious and in a form that can be put into an envelope and then distributed. So it's not easy to do any of these, and they all present with different kinds of obstacles for distribution. Having said that, the Centers for Disease Control and other public health authorities in this country have made up a list of infectious agents. The list is quite long. It's probably 20 to 25 different kinds of agents. Again, I want to emphasize that they all present significant problems, not just for all of us if we were to encounter them, but also for a person who wanted to disseminate them. It's not easy to do this.
So they would really have to have some kind of a science background and be willing to take the risk of becoming infected themselves.
That's right. Yeah.
For all of those agents on this list, are there vaccines for some percentage?
The only vaccines that are available and widely used for the agents that are in the top categories listed by the CDC are anthrax and smallpox. The others, there's just never been, in some cases, a reason to develop a vaccine. The diseases aren't common enough. In other cases, there has just never been money put behind the development of those vaccines because, again, either they're uncommon or too localized.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion about bioterrorism and vaccines.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Julia McMillan of the American Academy of Pediatrics and Johns Hopkins School of Medicine about bioterrorism and vaccines. How do you feel about vaccinating kids against any of these diseases?
Well, let me just talk about smallpox and anthrax vaccine. I mean, ideally, it would be lovely if we had safe vaccines to prevent any of these diseases, plus the diseases to which children are, in fact, exposed every day, unlike anthrax and smallpox. I want to emphasize that while we talk about vaccine for bioterrorist agents that are at this moment, as far as we know, not a threat to our children, we've just been through a year during which the vaccines that in fact protect children against the diseases they encounter routinely have been in such short supply in this country that we have had to defer immunization against pneumococcus, which causes pneumonia and meningitis, against tetanus, against chickenpox, and against measles and mumps and rubella infection.
Why has there been such a short supply?
It's a long story. I'm not sure we want to talk about it here today. It's been well publicized, but perhaps not as well as it should have been. The vaccine manufacturers have, for a variety of reasons, had difficulty producing enough vaccine. And again, I want to emphasize that these are diseases that our children, in fact, are exposed to. So while I think it's very important that we be concerned about protecting children against agents of bioterrorism, it's more important today that we make sure that they're protected against the diseases that we, in fact, know that they encounter. So to get back to whether they should be immunized against anthrax and smallpox, the answer is in some ways made for us. Anthrax vaccine exists only in very small quantities. It's probably a safe vaccine. The military and the public health authorities in this country have determined that it is. It's never, as far as I know, been used in children. We don't know anything about what the appropriate dose in children would be. It takes 6 doses given over a year to be effective, the vaccine that's currently available. So it's an incredibly cumbersome vaccine to use, and we don't even have the choice to use it, and it's never been tested in children. With regard to smallpox vaccine, we know more about it, and what we know is even worse. As I mentioned before, it's the vaccine that has been in widest use that has the highest amount of side effects, and it can kill people. When it was being used in the earlier part of this century, it was estimated that it killed about five or six out of a million people who received it. Again, to emphasize, this is a disease that, as far as we know, doesn't exist in this country. So to think that we would actually do something that might kill children to protect against a disease that doesn't exist, I think our public health authorities have wisely made the decision that that's not a risk we want to take. In addition, there are many side effects associated with this vaccine and particular vulnerable populations. We know that people who have deficiencies in their immune system, that would include children born with deficiencies in their immune system, as well as people with HIV and people who are receiving various kinds of immunosuppressive therapy for cancer, would all be more likely to suffer significant side effects than healthy people. We also know that this vaccine can cause severe life-threatening disease in people who have eczema. That constitutes about 15 to 20% of all children. So I want to just emphasize that, as most people know, the Centers for Disease Control Committee that makes or recommends vaccine policy to our federal government has just made a decision not to recommend widespread use of smallpox vaccine for anybody in this country except a small number of emergency personnel and hospital-based personnel that would be expected to have to respond very quickly if there were a bioterrorist incident involving smallpox. That decision was made with the consideration for all of these bad effects of this vaccine and weighing the risk against the potential benefit of being protected against a disease that, again, doesn't exist in this country today or in the world today.
In the event of a bioterrorist attack, what should parents know? What should we keep in mind?
There are a number of things that parents need to kind of have in their minds in the advent of a bioterrorist attack that, again, I want to emphasize, we have no idea whether that would affect one or two people or 10 or 15 as the anthrax attacks did, or a whole city. So it's very hard to mechanically explain to families what they should do. I think there are a number of ways that families and communities can be prepared in case of an attack. First of all, people need to have doctors and ways to get medical care. People need to have insurance that allows them and doesn't make them worried about seeking medical attention if a child has unusual symptoms and signs. That's partly a responsibility of the family itself, and I think it's also partly the responsibility of our society. So making sure that medical care is available and that that medical care is knowledgeable. So I think it makes sense for parents to know where they would go to seek care if they thought that there was a need to seek that care because of bioterrorism.
In the case of dealing with children, when we're really talking about, would it be the pediatrician would be the first line of defense?
Yeah, I think depending on how sick the child was, the pediatrician would certainly be, or the family practitioner or whoever is their primary care provider. They should have a primary care person who they would call. They have that person identified who provides care to their child. We need to be sure that in each community there are facilities, emergency facilities, appropriate to care for children. That's not always true. Some of the emergency response teams that have been deployed to address other disasters in this country don't even include pediatricians or people knowledgeable about the care of children in an emergency.
If we have such an emergency, heaven forbid, how would parents know whether there is such a response team in their communities?
Well, I think, again, this is all part of the preparedness that families can participate in. Most parents participate in their communities in some way. Many parents work in hospitals. Many parents work in schools. Many parents work with health departments or emergency response teams like the police and the fire department. Each of those organizations needs to have a plan that includes the care of children. I think one of the things that was most frightening for people who are concerned about children in retrospect about September 11th was how unprepared our school systems were. Those of us who were in the Baltimore, Washington area, and certainly I'm sure the New York City area felt this perhaps more strongly, but we were sent very mixed messages over the radio. Come pick up your children at school. Don't come pick up your children at school. I had colleagues who were leaving work, clogging up highways to go pick up their children. It probably was the last thing they needed to do. But we didn't trust our schools to have a plan that would involve both the immediate care of those children and a way to communicate with families. So I think that school systems and public health systems locally and in states and throughout the country need to have a disaster plan, whether it's bioterrorism or some other kind of terrorism. And parents and children need to know what to expect if something terrible would happen. Now, for bioterrorism, we're not likely to be talking about something that happens in a split second. We're talking about an illness that affects a small or a large number of children. So in this case, it's the hospitals and the public health systems and the doctors that mostly need to be prepared. The Centers for Disease Control and the federal government have just allocated large amounts of money to state and local health departments to try to put all these things into place. And as an example, each community is supposed to identify a hospital that would be the receiving hospital if there were a smallpox event. So those kinds of plans are underway. I think what parents can do is make sure they know about it. It is a time when parents need to read the newspaper and the internet and understand what's going on, not just nationally across the country or the world, but in their own communities, because that's where their children are going to need to be cared for.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion about bioterrorism and vaccines.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Julia McMillan of the American Academy of Pediatrics and Johns Hopkins School of Medicine about bioterrorism and vaccines.
So if parents don't find this information in those areas right now, newspaper, radio, or so forth, where would you advise them to call? Their local governments?
Their local health department.
Okay.
And their local pediatricians. Their pediatricians ought to know where they can get help. But if they don't, their local health departments can provide that information. Phone numbers and websites for local health departments should be pretty easily available. But if they're not, most local health departments do have websites. And if the local department doesn't, the state health department does and can link into information about local health departments.
So it's just like poison control now. We need to
absolutely have
that number right by the
you
telephone.
You absolutely do.
And maybe in our wallets, depending
yes.
on where we are.
And so do physicians who need to report any suspicious illness as soon as they see it.
Are there any preventive actions appropriate for parents or kids, things that we can do on an ongoing basis that would be helpful, besides worry?
Well, worry doesn't really help very
right.
much, unless it's turned into knowledge, and worry sometimes does push people to learn more. There's a lot of information available. I'm most familiar with what's on the internet because all of this has happened so fast that there aren't as easily available printed resources as there are available through electronics. The Centers for Disease Control, which has a very easy website to remember, it's www.cdc.gov, G-O-V.
Can you say that one more time? Everyone's reaching for a pencil. Okay. I can see across the country and around the world.
www.cdc.gov, G-O-V. it's a site that is intended for to help people under lots of different circumstances at different levels, both the lay public and medical professionals and public health workers. But there is a thing called Health Topics, A to Z, that's on that website that provides lots of information. And there also are other specific pieces of information and
resources,
thank you, on that website. The other website that I think is very helpful and also easy to remember is the American Academy of Pediatrics website, which is www.aap.org. I'll say it again, www.aap.org. That site not only has a lot of information, but lots of links to other information for both parents and pediatricians and other healthcare workers, nurses and nurse practitioners and family practitioners. And both of those sites have made it their goal to stay up to date. So if there is something new happening, it's very likely that the information will be posted within 24 to 48 hours. After September 11, the American Academy of Pediatrics site had information about dealing with fear in children posted within 48 hours. So I think those are good sites. And again, rather than give people a long list, they have links to other sites. And they have both specific information about bioterrorist agents and also general information about dealing with bioterrorism.
Young children are, as we know, likely to put all kinds of things into their mouths and to touch everything they see. Would you recommend specific preventive measures parents could take?
These are not infections that are likely to be in a child's day-to-day environment. This isn't something that I think we're going to discover because a child catches an infection in the daycare center. If one child in a daycare center develops infection due to smallpox, as an example, that's not going to be because they put their hand in their mouth. That's going to be because the virus was sprayed into the air or another child brought it in on their skin. So this is not, I think, something that one can address through cleanliness or hygiene. There's probably a little too much of that in the world already.
That's a little dirt is good for you.
Good hearing that from you.
Definitely. A little dirt is definitely good for you. So I think there's no particular reason to change our hygienic habits or our training of children as a result of concerns about bioterrorism. It is, however, important that we keep the habits of children in mind in the event of an attack. It's not as easy to control the actions of children. So if we knew that there was cutaneous anthrax in an environment,
skin on the skin,
or if there's anthrax in the environment in general, children have thinner skins than adults do. It's probably not a coincidence that one of the people who developed the skin form of anthrax was a 7-month-old baby who was taken into her mother's workplace at ABC. That child would have had very thin, delicate skin. It would have been easier for the bacteria to get in. Children also breathe at a more rapid rate than adults do. So something that goes through the air is potentially more likely to cause disease in a child. Their body surface area is smaller. So for diseases that cause dehydration, they're more likely to suffer that impact more quickly. And again, I want to stress that in some cases, our ability to care for children in an emergency is not as well developed as our ability to care for adults. Many of the protective measures like gas masks or antidotes that might be given not for bioterrorist agents but for other agents don't exist in a form in this country that's easily administered to children. So we have to be cognizant of the fact that we have a lot to do to protect children, both within our homes and in the community.
Well, this has been a scary topic, but also a reassuring discussion. And Dr. Julia McMillan, thank you so much for being with us and helping us to understand this very complicated issue.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 155. Tell us what station you're listening to if you can, since we're airing all over the world. It's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.